that takes us to Saylor versus State of Nebraska. I am recused from this matter. Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter, and Justice Papik is recused from this matter, and there are actually two Saylor versus State of Nebraska cases, and all three of us are recused from this matter, and so that means Justice Miller-Lerman will be presiding. Give us a second to leave the courtroom.
Good morning. Let me see what I can do to minimize confusion here. We're proceeding to initially Saylor versus State of Nebraska. That's the case that ends in 794. And my understanding, the court's understanding, is that's 10 minutes aside. That's this one that's up. Are you all in agreement with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. And thereafter, we're going to hear separately the Saylor case ending in 793, at which time the appellees are going to split their time. Is that where we're going?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so much for the housekeeping. Therefore, the court calls Saylor versus Nebraska 18-794. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, those of you who remain. good morning, counsel for the appellees. My name is Mike Wilson. I represent the appellant plaintiff in this matter, James Saylor. Mr. Saylor is an inmate in the Nebraska Department of Correctional Services, and several years ago he filed state tort claims using certain forms that are provided to the inmates, as well as instructions. And what happened was Mr. Saylor filed these forms. They have several fields on them, and among the fields that they contain is one that says damages, and or amount of damages claimed. And there's an asterisk next to this field that says it's a required field. Mr. Saylor decided at the time that he would file these forms or submit these forms the amount to be proven, or excuse me, in the amount of damages field he wrote to be proven. And he did that with all these forms, and the court will see that there are many forms in the record as he submitted more than a dozen claims.
Mr. Wilson, what is the purpose of requiring the statement of a specific amount in the form when it's submitted to the state risk manager?
Well, the state developed the forms, so the state argued, at least in the district court, that the purpose of that was to help it determine how it would respond to different claims in terms of, I guess, perhaps personnel and how it would evaluate each claim.
Suppose the fortuitous circumstance that the state risk manager said, gee, this looks like liability. We ought to pay it. How much should we pay? What does it do with a form that says to be proven?
I think in that circumstance, Your Honor, it follows its regulations published
And what do they say about that circumstance?
They say I'm sorry to interrupt you, Your Honor.
You didn't.
I believe what the form says is that they will evaluate the claim, investigate the claim, and from that investigation determine whether it's to be approved for further review or for payment eventually, or if it's going to be rejected. And that's what happened here. Actually, the forms were rejected, or the claims were rejected summarily, but they were rejected not for the failure to state an amount or place an amount, a dollar amount in these fields. They were rejected because, according to the Office of Risk Management, the forms failed to state sufficient, the facts didn't bear out the claims.
Counsel, I want to take you back to the dollar amount for
yes.
a moment. If Mr. Saylor were to sit down and try and put a dollar amount in that box, given the nature of his claims. His claims, as I understood them, were he was not provided necessary medical care. And as one who is incarcerated, he wouldn't be paying for his own care. How would he quantify the amount of his, the dollar amount of his damage claim?
That's a good question, Your Honor. And perhaps for an inmate, that's a difficult thing to do. He may not be able to. And in fact, one of the arguments that I have, I've highlighted in my reply brief, is that to impose strict compliance for certain claimants is an undue burden, and it's not consistent with the notions of justice that are discussed in West Omaha Investments. Now, I understand that the court didn't like West Omaha Investments. The court relied on Jill P., and that's a case that this court in which this court requires strict compliance. But what I also tried to highlight in my reply brief, and you can go through this, you have all these claim forms in the record. You have all the instructions that are published by the state in the record. And when you compare the instructions and the forms, you're going to find that the forms don't always match. The instructions don't always match what's on the forms. And if you're going to require strict compliance with something like a claim form or like instructions that are published by the Office of Risk Management of the state, you better have forms and instructions that can be strictly complied with. That's a big problem, I think, for the state in this case.
The claimant is seeking general damages and not special damages in a tort claim. What would the dollar amount be that would be appropriate?
Well, it does, Your Honor. I think it depends on the case. I understand, you know, that you could argue he could have written $1 million. You know, he could have written $100,000. Frankly, for him to have to determine that at the form submission stage is an undue burden, and it's not consistent with the Tort Claims Act's purpose. The Tort Claims Act purpose is to give someone like an inmate or an average citizen an opportunity to pursue justice when they've been wronged by the state.
The failure to complete the form, you're saying, is not tantamount to submitting the form.
Your Honor, that's correct. But I'm also arguing that the form was completed. So you've got an alternative argument that if this court finds that that form was not properly filled out or not sufficiently filled out, then given the state's acceptance of the form, initial evaluation of the form, and rejection of the form, under their own rules, they did not, what they should have done is they should have rejected the form as procedurally deficient. They didn't do that. And the state says, well, okay, let's accept Mr. Saylor's argument for a moment. If we accept that argument, then we're waiving all of our defenses by accepting and evaluating a tort claim form from an inmate or anybody else. I disagree. I believe that you can parse out the different defenses, procedural versus substantive. And there's no reason for Mr. Saylor to lose his claim in its entirety simply because he relied on the state's acceptance, evaluation, rejection of his claim form. Again, not on the basis of a procedural problem. If Your Honors wouldn't mind, I'll reserve the last 2.5 minutes here for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
May it please the Court. My name is Scott Strauss, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. A claimant seeking to file a tort claim is required to write the total amount of claim on the claim form.
Required by what?
Your Honor, the statute, section 81.8212, provides all tort claims shall be filed with the risk manager in the manner prescribed by the State Claims Board.
Is the purpose of that statute to govern a uniform procedure for filing the claim or to govern the content of that claim?
Your Honor, it is to, the purpose of that is to provide the entire process to be described and promulgated through rules and regulations by the Claims Board in the manner prescribed by the Claims Board.
And the state's claim is that by not providing content, particular content, on the established form, that the statute has not been complied with, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
That's not what the state told the claimant at the time, is it?
Your Honor, the state in its denial letter simply said there is no evidence of staff misconduct or negligence and did not specifically state in the denial letter that Mr. Saylor did not comply with the tort claim. That is correct. However, the requirement to put in that total amount is so fundamental to be able to, for an individual to, for the state to process and more to the point to potentially resolve a claim. And without having that total amount of claim for the state to evaluate, to be able to work with, then the claim submitted to the Tort Claim Board can never possibly be resolved.
What does manner mean in this context?
Your Honor, I believe the manner in this context means the...
Both the process and its content?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's your position?
That is our position, yes.
What do we say in West Omaha?
West Omaha, Your Honor, I believe is very distinguishable from this case.
Well, what do we say? Before you distinguish it, what
certainly.
Do we say?
In West Omaha, this court stated that because the act itself did not mandate that the claim contain the amount of damages, then that was good enough in that case. However, in this case, it's quite different because unlike the tort claims, the Political Subdivisions Tort Claims Act, where all one has to do is just submit a writing with those requirements specified in statute, the Tort Claims Act,
State Tort Claims
the
Act.
State Tort Claims Act, Your Honor, thank you, accounts for a much more involved process, which is why it specifically has the risk manager or the claims board to promulgate its own set of rules of how and what manner a tort claim must be filed. And in doing so, the Tort Claims Board came up with its rules and regulations on the process, in which it states that first, all tort claims must be on the form provided by the board, and then next, that all claims shall contain all information called for on the board's form.
And isn't the purpose of requiring the amount on the form to enable the state to determine how much we would pay if we're going to allow this claim? Isn't that the purpose?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And consequently, when the state says, oh, this doesn't qualify because of the circumstances, that purpose no longer has anything to do with the case, does it?
Your Honor, if I may inquire, are you referring to the rejection denial?
Yeah, the staff... Staff wasn't negligent.
It went to the merits, did it not?
The risk manager did deny on the merits, Your Honor. However, in the first instance, Mr. Saylor failed to comply with the requirements. And because this is indeed a waiver of the state's sovereign immunity, all waivers must be strictly construed. Even though this is not directly from the statute, it's still through the regulations and the form, and the backdrop is sovereign immunity,
at the time when rejection was made, he was still within the statute of limitations, wasn't he?
I believe for some of the claims, yes, Your Honor.
And so if the state had said, you didn't fill out the form correctly with the amount, he could have at that point filed another claim, right?
He could have, Your Honor.
And so the state sort of just doesn't say anything about it, and now after the statute's run, you want to rely on that? Is that what we're doing here?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the risk manager is not to be a filing assistant for every claimant.
Isn't that what the statute makes the risk manager?
No, Your Honor. The risk manager is to be the person to receive and subsequently evaluate and potentially pay out. In fact, the legislature emphasizes the importance of having that monetary amount when it chose to have different tiers of approval required or for any given tort claim.
So in a few minutes, the state will be arguing the other case involving Mr. Saylor, and the same claim form was used, and the same box was filled out in the same fashion. But the argument you're making in this case was not raised in the other case. Why not?
Your Honor, I believe the form was slightly different, in which it did not have the asterisk in the other case from 2012. It did not have the asterisk indicating required. With respect to making that argument now, I believe the statute of limitations argument was more convenient for the counsel on the lower level.
Thank you.
To make that argument. The legislature even accounted for how important it is to have that total claim amount. For example, the risk manager may approve and authorize and pay out of any claim of up to $5,000. Contrast that with any claim over $50,000, which actually requires the approval of the legislature itself and specific appropriation of funds. The legislature envisioned that the total amount of claim being just as vital. And when one compares the requirement to have the total amount of claim on the claim form, and you compare that with the other required information, the parallels will be seen. For example, the claimant's name, the claimant's contact information, the date and location of the occurrence or the event giving rise to the claim. Without having those pieces of information, the claim cannot be assessed, and more importantly, cannot potentially be resolved.
Suppose we disagree with the analysis for whatever reason that the absence of the amount made a difference. That's no longer, you lose on that. How do you win otherwise?
Your Honor, I believe that is the crux of our argument, that Mr. Saylor not putting to be an actual amount, instead foregoing the process and just writing to be proven, he failed to file adhere to the condition precedent.
If he had written in $20 million in that box, would you be making this argument?
No, Your Honor. If he had given an actual amount, that would, in fact, even if it were overestimated or exorbitant, it still would have potentially given the claims board and the actual tier of approval necessary a number to work with. And again, at that point, even again, if that number is quite high, it would be possible for the claim to be resolved.
What's the language of the form? Does it say amount?
The language of the form says total amount of claim.
So does that clarify its dollars? Could it be a billion simoleons?
It does not on the form. However, the standard operating procedure document, which was referenced in Mr. Wilson's brief, does actually clarify and state that the total amount of claim means the total dollar amount that the claimant is seeking.
But that's not on the form.
Yes, correct, Your Honor, it's not.
Just the words amount.
Yes, Your Honor, total amount of claim. If there are no further questions, the state requests that this court affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, 2 minutes and 26 seconds.
The state's argument, I believe, raises one sort of overarching question here that I can't seem to wrap my head around. If the damages amount is so fundamental to the resolution of the claim, how is the state able to deny the claim? The state denied the claim. And it didn't do it on the basis of Mr. Saylor's failure to list a specific dollar amount or simoleon amount or any other amount. So That's where I keep coming back to that.
What was their basis of the denial?
Failure to provide, the evidence didn't bear it out, essentially. I'm paraphrasing, but the evidence didn't bear out the claim.
Well, don't you have to have evidence of a claim before you get to the amount of the claim? I mean, isn't it logical to decide there's any wrongdoing before you decide how much it's going to cost you? Isn't that a reasonable, logical way to approach that?
Your Honor, I'm not saying it's logical or illogical to approach it that way, but I think we could all agree that state bureaucracy is not always logical or illogical. It could be that is a good way to bear out the claim, Your Honor. I agree with you to a certain degree. I understand, though, too, that when you deny something on the basis of a procedure, or if you divide, if you look at a due process, just a regular, from a litigation standpoint, which is what these forms are intended to do, they're intended to essentially avoid litigation when possible.
Is it possible for us to uphold the district court's dismissal saying, right result, wrong reason? And if it's not, why not?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. And I've thought about that from this case from different angles. I can't think of another way that the state could get around, like I said, waiver, estoppel, are the primary arguments here from our side of it. And if you're going to boot my client's claim out permanently based on a procedural error, he should have received an opportunity to correct that procedural defect.
This was brought as a 12B6 motion initially, correct?
I believe so, Your Honor.
What do the pleading rules say with respect to all available grounds for a 12B6 motion if one is filed?
I want to answer your question correctly, Your Honor, so I'm trying to make sure and as Your Honors know, I appear usually in this court on criminal matters, so you'll have to excuse me if my civil knowledge is not up to par, but I believe you have to plead all claims in the 12B6 motions, essentially, a motion suggesting that the complaint be thrown out based on failure to comply with all procedural and pleading requirements. Now, obviously, I'd like the court to correct me if I'm wrong, but that is my memory. And obviously, I'm also prepared to answer any questions you have following up on that.
Fine, thank you.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You're excused on this matter. Thank you.
Don't get too comfortable. You'll be up here.
Evidently, I'm not a very good housekeeper. Okay, next matter that we're calling is 18793. Mr. Wilson, you are back.